on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Good evening. Today is Friday, July 16th. I'm Chirag Mahajan, your sole host for News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. Good evening. It is 5:10, and we decided to run a little late because Nardwar's interview with Lenny from Motorhead was quite good. But now it is time for another 40 minutes of, or 50 minutes of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver. And we will have international news brought to you by Free Speech Radio. We will also talk with Cara Byrne and Leanne Fava from the Finity Project. All this plus your weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, and your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101. And now it's time for UBC campus and local headlines. A reporting project by University of British Columbia journalism students that ran in the New York Times has now led Brazilian authorities to arrest 18 suspected individuals in the murder of Indigenous leader Nicio Gomes. In February, the UBC reporting class traveled to southern Brazil to investigate resource and territory disputes between farmers and indigenous people. These students interviewed Gomez's son and nephew about the execution-style attack of the Guarani tribal chief, and their resulting video and story appeared on the New York Times website on June 9th. In the 5 weeks since these stories ran, 18 people have reportedly been arrested in connection with the Gomez murder, including the head of a major security firm that protects farmland from Guarani land reclamation efforts. Peter W. Klein, the director of UBC's Graduate School of Journalism and co-instructor of the global reporting class, said that, quote, "The students and I were never in danger, but the experience underscored for all of us that we were clearly touching a nerve," end quote. Peter Klein said there were many indications the Brazilian government did not want the story told, most notably their apprehension by federal police after a meeting with FUNAI, FUNAI, the Brazilian government agency that oversees indigenous affairs. The UBC project started when student Kaelin Shaw heard about Gomez's murder in November 2011. Shaw said, quote, "This was a really underreported story, and our goal was to give it the attention it deserves. These arrests are a good first step, but hopefully we inspire other news media and Brazilian government and Brazil's government to watch the process closely to ensure that convictions occur and justice prevails," end quote. In other campus news, six professors from North Korea's leading universities are currently staying in Vancouver to study capitalism and economics at the University of British Columbia on a six-month program, drawing fresh attention to the North's possible transition under Kim Jong-un. On Friday, Professor Park Kyung-hae, director of the Center for Korean Research, said that the economics professors from three North Korean universities arrived in Canada earlier this month to take courses at the University of British Columbia in the fall semester, which begins in September, after a two-month language course. Professor Park Kyung-hae said the North Korean professors will, quote, mainly study international business, economics, finance, and trade, end quote. In an interview with the Korea Times, Professor Park, who visited North Korea last month, said that, quote, there was no such long-term program related to North Korea in the past. The professors who completed last year's course did their best and had good relations with other professors and faculty members. As they successfully finished the course, we were able to continue the program this year as well. End quote. These North Korean professors are the second group of visiting professors to take the courses under the Canada DPRK Knowledge Partnership Program, which Professor Park helped launch at UBC last year. DPRK stands for North Korea's official name, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. In the fall semester of the last academic year, a group of six professors, five from Kil Ing Sung University, attended the program, which included meetings with CEOs of Canadian law firms, banks, insurance companies, and energy firms. New research from researchers at the University of British Columbia and Canadian Forest Services suggests that climate change is pushing British Columbia's ecosystems and its productive forests further and further out of sync with the weather conditions they need in order to thrive. British Columbia's 16 major ecosystems, everything from coastal rainforest to alpine peaks, are getting left behind as precipitation and temperature patterns shift in response to global warming. The trend is expected to create challenges for commercial species such as lodgepole pine, which will have less moisture to sustain them through hotter, drier summers, and opportunities for frost-averse species like the Douglas fir to extend their range. These climate envelopes that sustain those ecosystems have migrated, so often to the north and sometimes to the east, and even up barren mountainsides, by 23% from their boundaries in 1970, according to projections. The researchers from the University of British Columbia and Canadian Forest Services said they did not expect a 23% average shift to emerge until the 2020s. UBC Forest Sciences Associate Professor Zhongli Wang, who did the number crunching for the paper, said a small decline in average precipitation over the past 40 years has caused a surprising amount of mismatch between the ecosystem and climate zones. The challenge for BC, he said, is to ensure that forest management practices, such as replanting areas after logging, take into account the ability of seedlings to adapt to climate shifts. And now we go to our interview with Kara Byrne and Lee Ann Fava, co-founders of the Finity Project. This interview was conducted by our own Claire Eagle.
Lee Ann Fava and Kara Byrne are the two young women behind the Finity Project, a challenge that is seeing the pair compete in eight charity challenges around the world. They're doing this all while battling MS themselves, but raising awareness and funds for MS isn't their only goal. In fact, it's taken a backseat to the bigger picture that they have in mind. In the words of Leanne and Kara, Finity is about those who are beating the odds in life, who are in love with life, or who are simply fighting for more life. Their goal is to make every struggle a triumph, and so for more insight into this, we talk to them in our studio. I'm here today with Leanne Fava and Kara Byrne, who are working on the Finity Project. So girls, can you tell me a bit about that and what it is?
Kara and I will be doing an 8-episode series. So we're going to do 8 different charity challenges around the world for 8 different charities. Everything from running the New York City Marathon on the Michael J. Fox team for Parkinson's to, in 8 weeks, we're climbing the Great Wall of China for juvenile diabetes.
Wow, and what motivated you guys to do this and take on this project?
Well, Leanne and I both have MS, so when we met a year ago working at Bell and we discovered that, we decided to do something bigger than ourselves because of it. And yeah, kind of started developing the idea in January, and I'll be taking off in 55 days.
Wow, that's really exciting. I think it's really cool that you guys both have MS and you're doing all these different charity challenges that really bring attention to a lot of different medical conditions around the world.
So what was motivating you particularly to go after all these different medical issues that people faced?
One of the things that Kara has often said and taught me is that there's powers, you know, in numbers. So we want to champion our own disease as well as break down the barriers that segregate people with different diseases. So it's not just about MS or just about Parkinson's or cystic fibrosis. It's a movement, it's a global movement towards wellness. So it's not specifically to find a cure for one disease, it's so that we can all not just survive this life, but live it spectacularly well.
Yeah, that sounds great. And what kind of response have you guys had so far, just working on the project?
An overwhelming one, actually. When we launched the website and the Facebook page and the video, we had to actually turn our phones off because they were kind of going crazy on us from the response to it. But it's still spreading and still moving, and we need all the support that we can get to make this happen. But the response has been great so far.
That's fantastic. And you guys mentioned that you're going off to do the Great Wall of China in 55 days, is it?
We actually start our first one in Kamloops.
Okay.
We're doing the 12-kilometer bike tour for the MS Society of Canada.
Okay.
And that one's important because Kara doesn't know how to ride a bike. And again, we're filming the whole thing, doing 8 episodes. So we start filming on Friday. She's going to begin the learning process of riding a bike. So helmets and knee pads, shin pads, and all that fun stuff. From Kamloops, then we head over to China, and we do the Great Wall of China to raise money for juvenile diabetes. And the great thing about all of these different challenges is that we get to do every single one with someone who has the disease that we're championing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a young man coming with us who has juvenile diabetes. We're going to skydiving in London on my 25th birthday for the Cystic Fibrosis Trust with a young man who has CF, who's had a transplant, and he's going to hurl himself through the sky with us.
What kind of learning outcomes do you expect for both yourselves and then for people who are watching these episodes or following you guys?
I think something we're learning is that if you set the example, you set the bar, people will follow, which you're never really sure when you take a chance and take a risk like this. But the following that we've had has been really incredible. And I think we're just hoping to teach other people about finity, about what that is. So, recognizing the finite existence that you have, using that to motivate yourself. That's what we're hoping to teach people.
And that you can push yourself. We're learning how to push ourselves and what our capacity is and keep pushing those limits.
Okay.
And one of the things that we've learned every day since we started this project, as we learn everybody else's stories, is that human capacity for greatness.
Mm-hmm.
And while we learn it in ourselves and other people get inspired by that, their stories are just phenomenal.
Do you have any in particular that stick out to you that you want to share?
Oh, our first episode. So many incredible people. Yeah, Tristan?
Yeah.
Yeah, we met this. Oh, he was so great. We did the 24-hour hockey tournament, and we met this little guy, Tristan, who just wants to be a goalie more than anything in the world. But he can't go on the ice because he is at risk of having a seizure, so it's not safe for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he showed up, like, full hockey gear, goalie mask, everything, and did his interview with us dressed like that. And we could barely hold his attention because it's just eyes on the ice the whole time. And he was really hilarious.
We got to play road hockey with him after.
Yeah.
He plays road hockey once a week as a goalie.
Mm-hmm.
And that 24-hour hockey marathon, that was for the Rink of Dreams. So that was our first... that was the kickoff for Affinity.
Mm-hmm.
So Kara and I played, and it was to raise money for the Helpful Dream Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a Vancouver Island-based charity to help families that have children that are facing life-threatening illnesses.
Okay.
So Tristan got to go to Disneyland when he was going through quite a hard time, or they provide assistive equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so the stories, that was our first time actually experiencing these families and their stories and the humor they used to get through their struggles.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I guess you guys talked a bit about the meaning of the Affinity Project and why you chose it as that. And I think maybe when people first hear it, it does sound a bit sad, like, because thinking about the affinity of life. But I think the way you spun it, of course, like focusing on how like everyone was important and like really living for the now. Mm-hmm. Just maybe can you go into that a bit more and why you were inspired to pick that as a name?
Yeah, I mean, well, to start, I was 3 years ago, I was sitting in a film class, and my prof we'd watched a movie that actually addressed the topic of death, and we were talking about it, and he said that it's really sad the way that everybody kind of walks around really unaware of their finite amount of time on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be something that we are sad about, because it's a reality everybody will face at some mm-hmm. point. When we don't, none of us really know that. I think we assume that we're going to have, you know, days and days and days, and you just never know, or that you're going to be healthy your whole life, and maybe you will be, but it shouldn't. You know, the idea of that shouldn't. You shouldn't waste time. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You just never know where you're gonna. Yeah, what's gonna happen? So,
I think because. It's not meant to be morbid, it's meant to be exciting. There are a lot of things that have prompted Kara and I to wake up each day. Mm-hmm. We've said before, you know, life is what wakes you up in the morning. Mm-hmm. Finity, the awareness of that of your own finite existence, is what gets you out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
And Kara and I have both gone blind a couple times. I had heart surgery six years ago, and my heart stopped a couple times, so... When you can say, like, no, I've died twice, I've gone blind a couple times, like, those things, Kara's learned how to walk again, I've learned how to walk again, we've had these... When you wake up in the morning, you're already on the plus side of things.
Yeah.
So it spurs us to do this kind of stuff and show people that, man, there's so much out there that we can do and will do and we're excited to do.
And I think even if you live, you know, to 85 to 100, you should have 85 spectacular years. It shouldn't be, you know... that, well, I'll do things later. You should do everything you want to do now. I think it's really important.
Yeah, for sure. So that's a great message for people to hear and to remember. So if people want to support your campaign a little bit more, how can they get involved or follow you or watch these episodes?
Well, we are on Facebook, and social media is... This project wouldn't have been possible a few years ago, but social media is definitely helping us. So check out the Finity Project on Facebook. Like us, share us. We've got some videos up there of a trailer of our first episode and a promotional video that we did. We also have a campaign on Indiegogo, and that is what is going to be helping us fund this project, because the overall 8 different tracks, it's going to cost Kara and I to do them all about just over $30,000, with over 20,000 of that going to charity.
Right.
So our operational costs are really small. But to fund some of those operational costs, we've started this campaign on Indiegogo.
Mm-hmm.
So you can look up the Finity Project on there.
Yeah, I mean...
Twitter.
And we've got Twitter. We've got a Tumblr blog that's starting up soon, so you can follow our adventures there as well.
Awesome.
Yeah. And as far as the episodes go, we are in contact with a couple different networks right now. And, yeah, we'd love to... be able to tell you that, hey, as of January, this is where you'll be able to see us,
mm-hmm.
but we're waiting to figure out which channel we'll be featured on.
That's awesome. It sounds like you guys definitely have a great project going and pretty inspiring, so best of luck to you both.
Once again, that was Leanne Fava and Kara Byrne from the Finity Project talking a bit about their project, their ideology, and what they're doing. So if you want any more information, you can check out their website, thefinityproject.com, and we will be keeping you updated on how their search for a spot on TV and as well as film will be going, as well as an update on how they're doing on the project. So do keep listening for ongoing info. For News 101, I'm Claire Eagle.
And thank you to Claire and Kara Byrne and Leanne Fava for that really interesting interview, which we will pay attention to in the future as their series continues. For now, we're going to take a quick break. Do stay with us for your provincial, national, and international news.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
This month in Discorder, check out part 2 of our summer festival preview, which indulges you in the folky, the hippie, the eclectic, and the electronic. Discorder sits down with Hot Panda to talk about things like hot sauce, writing food blogs, and the ultimate battle for panda greatness. We also talk with the V Vecker Ensemble, who are the Captain Planet of Vancouver indie music. We talk with Ryan Smith of Green Burrito Records of the value of cassette tapes, and experience Sasquatch Music Festival through the eyes of Discorder. Don't forget to check out our regular columns like Filmstrip, where we review the film Better Than Something. Check out our events calendar for all the greatest upcoming shows, and our art project focusing on the work of Aaron Moran. You'll find the greatest in both recorded and live music in our Under Review and Real Life Action sections. All this and more in the July issue of Discorder, that magazine from CITR, on stands now.
Saturday, July 21st, CITR 101.9 FM, Scott T's Scenic Drive, and Combination 13 presents a very special night with the return of Easy Big Fella from Seattle and an EP release party for Vancouver's own Los Furios. It's happening at the Cobalt, 319 Main Street. Saturday, July 21st. Tickets at Scratch, Zulu, Highlight, Red Cat, and BrownPaperTickets.com.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. You can also listen to us online on our website, CITR.ca, or listen to that interview with the Finity Project and our other segments on our website, CITR.ca/news. It is now time for your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. So tonight, it's cloudy with a 30% chance of showers, windy near the water, so stay away from the beach, and with a low of 15 degrees Celsius. Saturday looks cloudy with a 40% chance of showers in the morning, and then a mix of sun and cloud as the evening progresses, a high of 22 degrees Celsius. Saturday night is partly cloudy, becoming cloudy near midnight, and a 60% chance of showers, and a low of 15 degrees. Sunday morning is also looks considerably rainy with a 60% chance of showers and a high of 17 degrees Celsius. And that does it for your weekend weather forecast here on CITR. You're listening to News 101, and up next we have your weekly health segment brought to you by our health team, Dietetics Intuition. On this week, it's all about fiber.
Hi everyone, this is Dietetic Intuition for July 16th. So the sun is out and we know what that means. July, summer, lots of fresh fruit and produce coming out of BC. And a lot of fruits and vegetables, as we know, contain lots of fiber, which is going to be the topic that I'm talking about today. I'm going to be talking about what exactly is fiber, the different types, and why it's important for your overall health, interesting health facts, and also really useful pointers from the Dietitians of Canada website to help you reach your goal of 38 grams a day for men and 25 grams a day for women. So we'll get started with what is fiber. Well, dietary fiber, specifically called dietary fiber, consists of naturally occurring plant materials that your body cannot digest, and these are found in whole grains, cereals, beans, lentils, fruits, and vegetables. There's another type called functional fiber, and these are manufactured or synthetic plant and animal materials that your body cannot digest. For example, you've heard of psyllium fiber, and they promote bowel regularity and control blood cholesterol and blood sugar levels. So why is fiber important for overall health? Well, it's linked with reducing your risk of heart disease, diabetes, obesity, and certain types of cancer. High fiber diets also provide bulk, and they make you feel fuller for longer. And people who have high fiber diets tend to have lower body weights, and many businesses have been taking advantage of this fact about fiber and how it makes you feel fuller longer. For example, PGX is a supplement that is mainly fiber that's dissolved in water, and it makes people feel fuller longer, and they eat less as a result. And apparently have been having some success about people losing weight through this. We know, you can do this naturally. You can include at least 6 servings of whole grain products a day, or at least eat at least 7 servings of vegetables and fruit a day. It's an easy way to increase your fiber and make yourself feel fuller for longer. And, you know, it's a little less expensive, I believe. Especially if you buy local and fresh produce. We have a huge list here of what's available right now, what's in season for July specifically. And this these growing seasons for the fruits and vegetables I'm about to mention can span a few months, either before or after. But just to name a few, apricots, chard, cherries, cucumber, green beans, kale, love kale, cauliflower and carrots. They're all in season out of BC, so if you're a big fan of the 100-mile diet, there you go. And so, again, how can we add more fiber to our diet, and what do we need to make sure we do? Well, you need to make sure that the more fiber you introduce, do it slowly, or else you're going to get a little bit of stomach upset, and drink lots of fluids along with it. And this is very important because fiber attracts water, and it can all wind up in a big clump in your digestive tract and create problems if you don't drink enough water per day. So back to what we need per day, 25 grams a day for women and 38 grams a day for men. And if you're wondering what exactly is a high fiber food is a food that contains 5 or more grams of fiber per serving. So when you look at your labels, it's really important to check out the labels of, say, a loaf of bread. If it doesn't have more than 5 grams of fiber per serving, which is usually about 1 slice, then it's not high fiber. Easier ways to include fiber into your diet are just don't peel your vegetables such as apples. Keep the peel on, especially potatoes as well. Add toasted nuts or sesame seeds or sunflower or pumpkin seeds to salads. And, for example, you can add tablespoons of bran, flax seed, fruit, or high-fiber cereal to your regular cereal in the morning. And basically eat fruit instead of drinking juice. Always include water, of course, in your diet, along with all these extra fiber introductions into your body. And that's about all we have for you today. Make sure you follow us on Twitter at CITR Health and on Facebook at Dietetic Intuition. And I will check in with you next Monday. Until next time, stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
And big thanks to our Dietetics Intuition Health team here on News 101. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines. More than 2,900 people, both scientists and non-scientists alike, from around the world, have signed an online petition aimed at saving a unique open-air freshwater laboratory from federal government budget cuts. About one-third of those signing the document come from outside Canada. And this is according to Heidi Swanson, a biologist helping organize the effort to save the so-called Experimental Lakes area. The experimental area, which includes 58 remote Ontario lakes and an on-site laboratory, has yielded crucial long-term data on concerns such as acid rain and fertilizer contamination. Scientists say it continues to be a base for research relevant to questions on the cumulative impacts of oil sands developments, how ecosystems process toxins such as mercury, and the effects of hydro development and climate change. Prime Minister Stephen Harper's Tory government has ordered it closed for next March for a saving of $2 million. Federal Environment Minister Peter Kent said he hopes another operator can be found for the program, such as a university or a group of universities. Minister Kent said, quote, "I hope the Experimental Lakes program doesn't close down. Environment Canada has found the Experimental Lakes over the past couple of decades extremely valuable," end quote. However, scientists have said universities are unlikely to be able to afford the kind of long-term commitment this requires. Elections Ontario says personal information about as many as 2.5 million voters in the province may have been compromised. Chief Electoral Officer Greg Asenza says the privacy breach involves voters in up to 25 ridings. He says experts are trying to determine which ridings were affected among 49 possible electoral districts. Asenza says data was on two memory sticks and the information was not encrypted or password protected. Names, birth dates, addresses, and gender of voters were among the data that was collected in last fall's election. Ontario's Information and Privacy Commissioner says the breach involves an, quote, unprecedented number of people. The data may also include information on whether or not these same individuals voted, but not how they voted. Ontario Provincial Police are investigating, and the three major political party leaders have been notified. The Alberta government is launching a pipeline safety initiative. Energy Minister Ken Hughes is to make an announcement about it later today in Calgary. Dozens of environmental, landowner, First Nations, and labor groups have been calling on the provincial government to conduct an independent review into pipeline safety. The calls for the review grew louder earlier this month when the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board lambasted Enbridge Inc. for its handling of an oil spill in Michigan 2 years ago. So far, there have been three pipeline leaks in Alberta this year, including the leak of up to 475,000 liters of oil into the Red Deer River, a major drinking water source in central Alberta. Enbridge is seeking approval to build a pipeline to ship Alberta crude over the mountainous British Columbia terrain to the west coast so that it can be sold in Asia at higher prices. Hundreds of, quote, forsaken youth, alumni, beneficiaries, and supporters of the slashed federal volunteer program, Katsimavik, will protest across the country this Saturday, July 21st, calling for the reinstatement of the 35-year-old program's $15 million annual budget. More than 600 youths have already been accepted into the program for this summer when the Conservative government announced the cuts in March, leaving many in the lurch and scrambling to make alternative plans for school and work. In an interesting piece of data, according to the Tai'i website, said that Montreal Katimavik alumnus Andrew Murchison, one of the organizers of the protest, said the aim is to keep pressure on the government over the summer. The issue is debated again in the House of Commons on September 18th. For more information, you can visit the Katimavik website, spelled K-A-T-I-M-A-V-I-K. Canada's Competition Bureau is pushing ahead with its own probe of a mushrooming international scandal that has already ensnared a British bank and forced the resignation of its chief executive. Documents filed in an Ontario court suggest the Bureau is investigating a possible Canadian link to the scandal that's rocking the world of global banking. One of the named parties, the Canadian branch of the Royal Bank of Scotland, has filed a court challenge on the grounds the Bureau's actions are unconstitutional and well beyond the scope of its mandate. But the investigation hasn't stopped, said Gabrielle Tess, a spokesperson for the Competition Bureau. The LIBOR rate, which is the London Interbank Offered Rate, is a benchmark setting that influences borrowing costs for businesses, financial institutions, governments, and consumers. So far, the scandal has cost British bank Barclays about $455 million in fines and forced the resignation of its chief executive, Bob Diamond. The Canadian court documents offer an expansive picture about how and when the six international banks allegedly colluded to fix the yen-denominated rates. And they are based on an asset that investigators in any complex investigation would crave: a whistleblower who has traded immunity from prosecution in exchange for turning on his or her fellow conspirators. Based on the whistleblower's testimony, the Competition Bureau received a court order last year to force 5 Canadian affiliates of international banks and one cash broker to turn over documents relating to the alleged collusion between 2007 and 2010. The alleged participants are the Canadian branches of Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC, Deutsche Bank, JP Morgan Bank, and Citibank, as well as ICAP, Intercapital, an interdealer broker active in the wholesale markets in interest rates, credit, commodities, foreign exchange, and equity derivatives. The allegations have not resulted in any charges, and the documents do not indicate any alleged wrongdoing took place in Canada. The documents suggest the Canadian Bureau has been pursuing the matter since at least January 2011, long before allegations of LIBOR rate fixing began dominating headlines earlier this month. And those are your provincial and national headlines here on News 101. We are going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international news brought to you by Democracy Now!
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Australia and Canada are both countries with a whole lot of space to create some of the wildest sounds on the planet. Join your host Matthew as he explores the musical heritage of his native Australia and features fresh sounds from Canada's independent music world. That's Stranded, the Australian-Canadian music show, live Fridays from 6 to 7:30pm on CITR 101.9 FM.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. You can also check out our latest interviews and segments on our website citr.ca/news. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for our international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now!
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 14 people have been killed, more than 50 wounded in a mass shooting at a movie theater outside Denver. A gunman wearing a gas mask and bulletproof vest set off what appeared to be a smoke bomb before opening fire. Police say the suspect is in custody and that he's believed to have acted alone. The attack came at a screening of the new Batman film in the Denver suburb of Aurora. 10 people reportedly died at the scene, 4 later succumbed to their injuries in hospital. A number of the wounded are in critical condition. It was the worst mass shooting in the U.S. since the killings of 32 people at Virginia Tech 5 years ago. We'll have more on this story after headlines. Syrian rebels continue to make gains on the regime of Bashar al-Assad, seizing a number of border crossings with neighboring Iraq and Turkey. Opposition fighters overrun government forces at 2 major crossings, including one controlling the vital trade route on the Damascus to Baghdad highway. Meanwhile, the Syrian government says the country's intelligence chief, Hisham Ikhtiar, has died from injuries sustained in Wednesday's bombing at a high-level meeting in Damascus, making him the 4th Assad regime insider to die in the attack. Amidst the violence, the United Nations is warning 1 million Syrians are now believed to be internally displaced, double the previous estimate. The fighting continues in Syria one day after Russia and China vetoed a Security Council resolution threatening new sanctions on the Syrian regime. Russia and China say they took action over demands for the inclusion of penalties under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which would leave open the possibility of military intervention. The measure would also have extended the UN observer mission in Syria for 45 days. Shortly after the veto, a spokesperson said UN Arab League envoy Kofi Annan is disappointed the measure failed to pass.
Well, the joint special envoy is disappointed, to say the least, that the Security Council could not unite and take the strong and concerted action that he had urged for and hoped for. And as you know, the voice of the Security Council is much more powerful when its members act as one.
Thursday's action marked the third time Russia and China vetoed a resolution on Syria in the past 9 months. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Susan Rice, condemned the veto.
The Security Council has failed utterly in its most important task on its agenda this year. This is another dark day in Turtle Bay. One can only hope that one day, before too many thousands more die, that Russia and China will stop protecting Assad and allow this council to play its proper role at the center of the international response to the crisis in Syria.
Russia has said it used the veto in a bid to prevent any future pretext for military force. Speaking at the UN, Russian Ambassador Vitaly Churkin claimed the U.S. and its allies are seeking to target the Assad regime as part of a bid to weaken Iran. Tens of thousands of people marched in cities across Spain on Thursday in the largest protest to date against massive spending cuts and tax increases pushed through to obtain a bailout for the country's banks. Demonstrators took to the streets as Spanish lawmakers approved a new round of austerity measures in Parliament, including a higher sales tax and cuts to the wages of public workers. Spanish union leader Ignacio Fernández Tocho said the new austerity measures threaten Spain's future.
This is a true aggression against the workers out of work, against the workers from the public sector, against the self-employed, against the professionals, against the middle class of the society who will go straight to poverty as a result of this plan. This is a plan of budget cuts that goes against Spain's economy. In economic terms, it's suicidal.
In Madrid, Thursday's protests ended in unrest when police fired rubber bullets at demonstrators at the close of a massive march. A military judge has rejected a bid by attorneys for the alleged U.S. Army whistleblower Bradley Manning to cite evidence showing the leak for which he's accused caused no damage to the United States. Manning's attorneys had sought to present damage assessment reports that evaluated the impact of the publication of government diplomatic cables that Manning allegedly provided to WikiLeaks. Internal government reviews have found the leak caused minimum damage, contradicting prosecutors' contention Manning harmed national security and aided U.S. foes. But on Thursday, the judge overseeing Manning's military trial rejected the effort, saying the impact of the leak is irrelevant to Manning's case. The judge also rejected a defense request to present testimony from United Nations Rapporteur Juan Mendez, who said the U.S. government's treatment of Manning may amount to torture. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta has ordered top Pentagon officials to monitor major U.S. news organizations for signs of leaked classified material. The order comes after recent media reports about U.S. cyber operations against Iran and the Obama administration's policies for targeted drone attacks overseas. Panetta announced the monitoring Thursday after discussing the leaks before a closed-door congressional hearing. On the campaign trail, Republican candidate Mitt Romney is preparing to head overseas for a trip that'll take him to Britain, Israel, and Poland. Speaking in Florida Thursday, President Obama said U.S. support for the Israeli government transcends the partisan divide.
And I want everybody here to know, under my administration, we haven't just preserved the unbreakable bond with Israel. We have strengthened it. We've stood by Israel's side in the face of criticism. Our military and intelligence cooperation has never been closer. I want you to know that that's something that should transcend party. That's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. That is an issue of how we work with one of our closest allies in the world that shares our values and believes in democracy.
New figures show the number of claims for unemployment benefits rose by 34,000 last week, the biggest jump in over a year. The official unemployment rate remains at 8.2%, with 75,000 jobs being created on average per month, down from 226,000 during the year's first quarter. A class action lawsuit alleging widespread discrimination against Latinos by the notorious Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio opened on Thursday in Arizona. Plaintiffs represented by civil rights groups are accusing Arpaio of violating the rights of Latinos by systematically targeting them for traffic stops and detention. Among evidence cited in court papers are Arpaio's own statements about his, quote, pure program intended to, quote, go after illegals, not the crime first. One plaintiff is a Mexican tourist who is a passenger in a car pulled over by deputies ostensibly for speeding. Though the white driver was neither arrested nor cited, the Mexican passenger was arrested despite having a valid visa and identification. The suit also says Arpaio punished prisoners for speaking Spanish and neglected to investigate a massive number of sex crimes. It precedes another suit brought by the Justice Department alleging rampant civil rights violations by Arpaio's office. The Pentagon's announced it'll allow U.S. service members to wear their uniforms at a gay pride march for the first time. The permission was granted for Saturday's pride parade in San Diego, California. The Pentagon says the move does not mark a permanent shift in policy and will only apply in this one case. A new report has found police in major U.S. cities are confiscating condoms from sex workers, putting them at risk of contracting HIV/AIDS. Human Rights Watch says police are harassing, threatening, and even arresting sex workers and transgender women solely for carrying condoms. In at least three cities, prosecutors introduced condoms as evidence at trials. Some sex workers who are afraid to carry condoms are reported having unprotected sex or using plastic bags as substitutes. The report also notes widespread profiling and other abuses by police, including reports police in Los Angeles and New York demanded sex in exchange for dropping charges and coerced women into sex while they were detained. In related news, U.S. restrictions are preventing many people most affected by HIV/AIDS from attending the International AIDS Conference scheduled to begin in Washington, D.C. Sunday. The U.S. categorically bans sex workers and drug users from entering the country unless they can obtain a special waiver. Sex workers and their allies are protesting their exclusion by holding a separate conference called the Sex Worker Freedom Festival in Kolkata, India, later this month. Speaking ahead of the India conference, Andrew Hunter of the Global Network of Sex Work Projects said the U.S. is discriminating against sex workers.
They are the largest funder for HIV services and providing antiretroviral medicines for people with HIV, yet they are completely hypocritical when it comes to the involvement of sex workers in not only in the International AIDS Conference, but the role of sex workers in controlling the HIV epidemic globally. So we're not allowed to go to their conference, but we're also not allowed to get their money for HIV prevention programming.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world.
In Russia, rights advocates continue to push back against a set of new laws that broadly limit social freedoms. The crackdown comes amid a rise in political activism that started last December. President Vladimir Putin has called for calm, but more suppressive laws are in the works. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
Under the new laws set to go into effect in the fall, non-governmental organizations will be required to register as foreign agents if they receive support from abroad and engage in political activities. The government will create a blacklist of internet sites that some have compared to the Chinese government's firewall. Fines for participating in unsanctioned political demonstrations have been greatly increased, and libel has been criminalized. Russian President Vladimir Putin met with some opposition members of parliament on Thursday about the new laws. He said they are part of the government's effort to ensure orderly political and social development that is appropriate for Russia.
All of these decisions were the right ones and were motivated by the changing situation in our country. And I noted at the start the importance of keeping up with the situation. We always must remember, when we're making our decisions, where we are, what challenges we face, what consequences each decision might have, and how they will affect our country's life in general.
A surge of popular protests that began in December ended years of quiet acceptance of Putin's rule. Maria Lipman is a political expert at the Carnegie Moscow Center.
Mass protesting first against rigged elections and then gradually evolving as anti-Putin protests, with tens of thousands in Moscow taking to the streets and chanting "Russia without Putin," is a new reality.
Lipman says the government's reaction to the development of political activism has come in the set of restrictive new laws.
The government would not join a dialogue with those constituencies that are increasingly unhappy and even outraged. And there was no way to maintain a status quo. So an obvious option is a crackdown.
The new laws will allow the authorities to act against critics through legal means without resorting to violence, says Nikolai Baranov, a political scientist at the State Military Institute.
The state is setting up the political field such that it is not connected with violence and is governed by the rule of law. For this, the best option is to make laws that protect the authorities as much as possible from critics, and at the same time, do not permit us to say that we have suppression, to say that we do not have freedom of speech or human rights, or that the security agencies are behaving outrageously.
In addition to the new federal laws, a law banning the propaganda of homosexuality went into effect in St. Petersburg in March. 73 people have already been arrested under the ban, the police department reported Friday. Igor Kochetkov is the head of the St. Petersburg LGBT rights organization Coming Out.
Actually, what is being shown is that our lawmakers are a bunch of incompetent people who became very afraid over the past 6 months. They saw that something is happening that they can't control, but they don't know how to control it. They won't be able to control it. They hope that they will manage to intimidate someone, to prohibit something. They are deeply mistaken. It is impossible to prohibit the civil society that is actively developing now in Russia.
The political situation will further develop in fall when more restrictive legislation is expected, including the regulation of the activities of volunteers and the registration of media that receive foreign funds. The new laws will take effect during the next election season. Again, Baranov.
In fall, there will be new elections, elections of regional authorities and governors. And in that period, it will already be impossible for the opposition and dissenters to do what they did before the summer of 2012.
At the same time, activists say they will join together and continue their work. Lipman says the situation is unprecedented.
The situation has become uncertain and unpredictable, and this is the first time ever during Putin's rule that any such thing happened. A crackdown on actually the societal forces.
Activists are planning for a major increase in participation in the opposition movement in the fall, as well as holding more events. The next national action is planned for September 15th. Екатерина Данилова, FSRN, St. Petersburg, Russia.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio, News and Democracy Now! For bringing us those international headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their respective websites, fsrn.org and democracynow.org. And that's our program for today, July 20th, 2012. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, please contact us via our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. And for more independent news, please join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by me from the entire news team here at CITR. Thank you for listening. And do stay tuned for Stranded with your host, Matt, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.